My dear guests, I am Mr. Raw, your host. Welcome to Fantasy Island.
No, it's Politics and Reality Radio. Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm your host, Joshua Holland. This week we'll speak to Helene Olen about United Airlines penchant for bloodying their passengers. Hey, it's a business model and what it reveals about American society. Then two guests named Christine. Christine Grimaldi is from Rewire News. She's going to explain how Obamacare is still vulnerable, even if congressional Republicans can't find common ground on how to kill it. There are other ways to undermine it. She's going to discuss those. And then finally, we'll speak with Korea expert Christine An, who will help us understand what the hell is going on between Trump and Kim Jong-un. The outcome is unlikely to be good. It's a full show, so we'll have to forego our usual introductory patter. We'll take a quick break and then dive right into it. Welcome back. I'm Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Helene Olen. Helene is a very smart writer. She's the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, and the co-author with Harold Pollack, who we had on the show just the week before last, of The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. Helene Olen, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Now, I understand, a little birdie told me that you are also going to be doing a regular column for The Nation.
Yes, I am, probably starting in the next week or two. I did one as a guest post about a month ago on Donald Trump's taxes, and I'm guessing that might be the topic of the next one, but I'm not 100% certain yet.
Okay, I'm very excited, and we'll have to have you back on to talk about Donald Trump's taxes. It is a topic that we have we've scratched before. We've had David K. Johnson on to talk about that in the past. Anyway, it's been a great week for outrage Twitter. We had the Pepsi brouhaha. Then Sean Spicer claimed that Hitler never used chemical weapons, which was interesting, to say the least. And finally, we had the video of poor David Dow being brutally dragged off of a United flight. I should note that Dow's lawyer said that he'd lost two teeth in that melee and may require surgery. Helene had an interesting take about this last story at the New York Times, and listeners can Google it. It's titled, United Airlines is Not Alone. Helene, you see this incident as a kind of microcosm of like larger forces in our society. Lay out your argument for us.
Thank you. Yeah, I do. I always feel these outrages tell us something about what is on our minds at the moment, right? People don't, get into mass outrages about everything. So you have to start asking, what are they reacting to? And I think for United Airlines, what was going on is that it's really kind of a microcosm for how we live now, where there's a very small group of people who are getting treated better and better, who can kick you off of your seat, right? who are in first class that are getting, fed food on a plate glass plates while you are, stuffed in the back with less room than ever. And then the rest of us who are sort of being bullied and treated badly, and in this case, being assaulted by security, frankly. I mean, and I think it sort of ended up being a touchstone for people of how they felt their status was sort of coming down in the world.
There was a story that came out just after this whole thing about David Dow as a passenger, a wealthy passenger who had a lot of connections in first class, and he got bumped for somebody who was of a higher priority, according to United Airlines. And I thought that this was interesting in that we often talk about the predations of the 1%, but there is a tension between the 1% and the like 0.001%. And that played out in that story. And the other thing that struck me about that is that here you have a wealthy traveler, and what he did was he immediately hired a lawyer and said, I'm going to sue the hell out of this airline. The video of David Dow is, in a sense, democratizing force, isn't it? Like, so he doesn't necessarily have the wherewithal to hire a fancy lawyer to sue United over this, but nonetheless, he managed to get his outrage very much in the attention of the public.
I would argue that the two are linked, and I actually made some of this point in the original Twitter thread that inspired the New York Times piece. You know, Dow was a doctor, and he was screaming that he was a doctor who had to go to his appointments the next day, right? So he wasn't, it wasn't like he was some random person. He was establishing his status. He was important. And I think one of the things we're starting to see go on, and that is concerning in its own way, is that you are seeing this sort of culling of the herd almost of the top 0.1% versus everybody else. And this is a group, right? And whether they're doctors or they're this guy in first class in David Lazarus' story in the LA Times that you referenced, that is used to being treated with a lot of deference and a lot of respect. And they think they're pretty darn important. And most people around them actually think they're pretty darn important too. And yet, as the system has become more and more calibrated to the wealthiest, and it's sort of trying to micro separate people into how much money they can get out of them, they're increasingly realizing, actually, no, they're shark chum too. They're not important either. And I think that's also part of the outrage. And I think it's a really important point, because that's not a good point for society, where pretty much everybody, except for a tiny little sliver of the population, much less than 1%, feels that they're on the outside.
My bad for saying that LA Times piece was reported by the Huffington Post. You're right. You talk about Americans' dissatisfaction with Congress, with government, as if it's a proxy, in a way, for the piss-poor way we're being treated on a daily basis by corporations. You think people are kind of transferring their frustrations onto the government?
Know if it's that they're transferring as much as it's part and parcel, right? The survey results show that most people say the government is completely unresponsive to them. In fact, when we look at this is absolutely correct, right? Government is unresponsive to people. We know people want expanded Social Security. Government routinely talks about cutting it back, right? When it was studied by some people at Princeton and Northwestern a few years ago, they found government extremely responsive to the concerns of the top tier of the population, not so responsive to everybody else. But people don't actually deal with government on a daily basis. They deal in the marketplace, right? We're a capitalist society. We go shopping on a daily basis. We fly airlines. We take trains. We go to the doctor, right? These are all exchanges of money. And in these transactions, people are kind of living the same thing, where they feel like they're getting less and less and less. And in many cases, they're quite right about that. It's not just some feeling of, oh my God, things are going downhill. In fact, they are going downhill. To give one example, in flying economy class in an airline, even if you're paying money for extra legroom, you are still not getting as much legroom as you received in the 1990s. And again, in first class, people are being treated better and better and better.
And we're getting bigger and bigger and fatter, and the seats are getting smaller,
too,
and it's
right?
becoming less. That's awful. I've often said that if you gather the world's greatest minds and you put them in a room and you said, come up with a plan to make air travel as unpleasant as possible. I think that they would fall short of what most carriers do today. And I should add that United is one of the worst, and they seem to get caught up in a lot of these online outrages. Let's remember that it's the same airline that refused to board two little girls for wearing leggings a couple of months ago. And then there was a story, and this was in the Huffington Post, and that's maybe why I was getting it crossed up. They ran a story, an account by a woman who says she was sexually harassed by this drunk guy, and the United flight crew just kept bringing him drinks.
Yeah, you know, United has had this reputation for a long time. And based on my experiences flying it, which have not been amazing, I would say there's a reason it tends to end up in these outrages more often than anyone else.
Yes.
But it really is astonishing. And I think it goes back to the fact that they control, that many of the airports they fly out of, they're one of two dominant carriers. So there's no responsiveness, right? This is, you know, we had nine major airlines a decade ago. We're now down to four. No surprise, people complain about airline service a lot, right? When you don't have options, you're not going to get treated that well. There's no money in making you feel like you belong there, or you should be treated like you paid the money to be on there. United has been, but United has been challenged for a long time, no question about it.
And as you mentioned, we don't have a lot of competition, especially if you live near an airport that is a major hub for one of these airlines. I find myself, I'm going on vacation, a long overdue vacation, in 10 days from now, a week from now. And lo and behold, I'm flying United. I booked that flight before this whole brouhaha happened. I wonder to what degree this is also a story about globalization. And here I'm going to get away from airlines specifically and just talk about customer service more broadly. I think of myself as a relatively enlightened lefty. I believe I'm pro-multiculturalism or pro-immigration. But I will confess that when I get on the phone with a company's call center in some far-flung country where the labor is cheap and English is a second language, I get really frustrated. Now, I blame the company for cutting corners rather than the person on the other end of the line who's trying to make a living. But it does give me a sense of isolation. Your thoughts?
I agree. I think it's funny. One person wrote to me after the article appeared in the New York Times and said, you know, and just started to describe their dealings with their cell phone company. Actually, several people wrote to me about their dealings with cell phone companies. And one said, I finally figured out how to get through to Sprint. If you hit zero five times, you get an operator. He said, but you know how I figured that out? I was so angry, I just started pounding the phone. but it is true. It is, people just feel cut off and dismissed. And they feel that way for a reason. I mean, I feel that way when I'm talking to these people, too.
I
had an insurer call me the other day, and they were reading loads of questions. And I was like, I'm working. Can we do this later? And they were like, no, we need to do this. It's like, you don't have power, right? There's no way you can do anything. And in turn, many of these people, they don't really have power either. It's not like they're calling you up or you're getting the Sprint, to continue the example, operator, right, who's, you know, empowered in her workplace, or the steward on United who's empowered to, like, make you happy. They actually have to follow these rather onerous rules, too. I mean, they're as trapped in an abusive system as we are. I mean, that's part of the issue. Workers don't have any rights in that way.
That's right. And there is some hierarchy of awfulness: airlines, insurance companies, and cable companies. I don't know exactly how to rank them. I guess your mileage may vary, but those are the most annoying three in my experience. There's a couple of other ways of looking at this story. What does it say about our corporate culture?
Nothing good.
Well, nothing good, but let me ask specifically, so as far as, like, short-term thinking, they lost $1 billion in stock value. When we say lost, that's not permanent. But they wouldn't raise
United
their offer. But here's the thing.
Monopoly.
But here's the thing that strikes me. They wouldn't just raise their offer to those passengers until they got a volunteer. And it seems to me that that's how capitalism is supposed to work. There's a supply. The guy has his seat. There's a demand. They want that seat. and the market determines the ultimate price. And what they did was they offered 400, they offered 800, and then they started bringing in the cops. And that's not how capitalism is supposed to work.
No, and what's hysterical is that some of the other airlines actually seemed to pile on when word of this got out and pointed out that, I think Delta was among them, that they actually will pay people more money to get off the plane, which is how capitalism is supposed to work, right? Your competitors show you up. But no, they felt that they didn't have to do that. And they probably would have been right if it wasn't for this man who, like, basically refused to go, right? The two other people they selected had simply left the plane and exited, probably not very happily. No one has heard from them since.
Maybe they killed them. It's possible. You never
know. They could be gone, right?
Maybe they made them into Soylent Green.
But they did get away. They would have gotten away with it, and they frankly, probably have in the past many, many times.
I'm sure they have. And
the airlines specialize in this sort of nickel and diming, right? You know, one of the things that was going on at United is that they've got it now down to such a fine tier of what you pay for, is that at the lowest economy ticket price, you don't even get access to the overhead bins. I mean, that's a whole new level of crazy.
Yeah, I have not encountered that one so far, although I may next week on United. What does it say about their contempt for their customers that they sell more seats than they have?
Well, it partly says that they're a monopoly or borderline monopoly in many places. It says that people don't really have options. It says also, however, that many of us are quite price sensitive and will fall for these scams and they basically are scams in a way, I should say, you go online and you look for the cheapest ticket price and it doesn't occur to you to ask, well, can I bring my suitcase on? Will they treat me like a human being? People literally don't, a lot of people, not everybody, don't think that way. And that's part of the issue, too. But again, a lot of, I should say, it's not just people, right? It's also that people are often flying on business, and your business is demanding you do this, right?
Yes.
They're not letting you spend the extra $40 on a ticket on a different carrier that might treat you better. They're booking you as well. So that's part of the issue as well. And I would say, to digress for a second, the other part of this issue is that, the rules around this stuff, by which I mean government legislation, is not particularly robust, right? So in a capitalist market where these rules are not robust, you are almost inevitably going to have some form of race to the bottom if people are going to be choosing, or a significant amount of people are going to be choosing tickets by the cheapest price. If you had the government come in and simply enforce some rules like if you sell a ticket, you can't boot people off the plane, right? Because that's part of the issue, that
it's
planes
a contract.
Can be oversold. Yeah. Why can planes be oversold if most of the tickets are unrefundable? That doesn't make sense, right?
Yes.
I can't sell more articles than I write and just say, no, I don't feel like writing this after all. Never mind, pay me anyway. I mean, it doesn't work that way. I wish it
really,
did. My life would be a lot
It really does
better.
Not work that way. Oh, yeah, it's pathetic. Now, I should just add that the incident was aggravated by United's PR people or social media people. The CEO made a statement that made matters much worse. They fell back on the fact that they politely asked for volunteers, as if that justifies beating up their customers. They abused the term volunteer. Volunteer does not mean do something or I will beat you. That's not volunteering. They mismanaged the entire thing. And it was one of those things where almost the cover-up is worse than the crime, right? There is a sense of that.
And that's another part of the increasing corporatization of our lives, frankly. I mean, take the term sharing economy, right? I'm not the first or the last to make this observation. It's not sharing if money is exchanging hands. This is like some sort of Orwellian doublespeak.
Right.
And it was the same thing. We were looking for he volunteered to leave the plane. No, he didn't. And it's not a volunteer refused, even if their money's exchanging hands. Somebody's getting paid to leave the plane.
I mean, the statement he refused to volunteer is just fundamentally odd. And what it shows to me is a sense of entitlement. Like, we can do whatever we want and get away with it. Anyway, Helene Olin, I believe we are out of time, unfortunately, but I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us this week.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
And folks, look forward to Helene's upcoming column in The Nation. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Christine Grimaldi from Rewire.
You know, life is funny when you look at it. Everybody wants love, but everybody's afraid of love. You know, I'm a true believer of that. If you get anything out of life, you got to put up with the toils and strife. Now listen. Ooh, you're pushing my love a little bit too far. I don't think you know. How blessed you are. And your friend Annie Mae tell you all she see. Have you ever thought she was trying to get close to me? Yeah. Think it over. Think it over, girl. That's the way I feel about you. And if that's been weak for you, I don't mind, I don't mind, I don't mind, I don't mind.
That's the way I feel about you.
Ooh.
That's the way I feel about you.
Baby, the world don't give enough of, give enough of. I know you've been hurt, and so has others too. But all you got to do is ask about the changes that life will put them through.
Oh, Lord, that's just the way it is.
Don't take my love as a sign of weakness. Check into the situation, girl. Dig a little bit deeper. That's the way I feel about you. Oh, that's the way,
that's the way I feel about you.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. We've discussed healthcare quite a bit on this show since Donald Trump became president. Republicans are reportedly going back to the drawing board to repeal and replace Obamacare yet again. It is unlikely, though, that they can bridge this divide. The first effort was derailed because the so-called Freedom Caucus, the hardliners, won't accept anything that doesn't cause an enormous amount of pain, which more vulnerable members can't support without committing political suicide. This basic calculation hasn't changed. But behind the scenes, there's a lot that Donald Trump and his head of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, can do to undermine the law using their executive powers. I am pleased to welcome Christine Grimaldi to the show to talk about some of those things that they could do. Give us a little heads up about what might be ahead. Christine is a D.C.-based reporter for Rewire News, or the artist formerly known as RH Reality Check. Christine, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Christine has two pieces about the GOP's regulatory assault on the Affordable Care Act at rewire.news. That's not .com, .news. Listeners can check them out. The easiest way is probably just to search for Christine Grimaldi's author page. Can you briefly explain the difference between statutory and regulatory policies in the Affordable Care Act?
Sure. This was a concept I had to relearn myself.
Yes.
So some policies are known as statutory, and because they live in the text of Obamacare itself, they're law, so they can't be changed without changing the law, and that's what congressional Republicans tried and failed to do recently. But other policies are known as regulatory, and they come in the form of guidance documents or rules or regulations, and they have the force of law, but they are written and enacted through the federal agencies by those unelected bureaucrats. And that's where we could see a lot of damage done to the Affordable Care Act and to these so-called women's health benefits in particular.
And do you think regulatory changes might result in the same kind of backlash, the same kind of resistance as the attempts to undo the legislation have? Or do these things tend to fly under the public's radar?
I think they tend to fly under the public's radar a little bit. I believe I wrote in the first place, in the first piece, that the federal agencies are even less transparent than Congress. You don't have, your own representative or senator to contact. But there are ways that people can weigh in. You know, the comment period, for instance, is not just open to stakeholders in D.C. They're open to the general public. So if there is a proposed regulation that you don't like and know will hurt you or other people, you can comment on that. And the federal agencies are required to take into consideration, at least read them, all of those comments. Now, will this administration act in good faith and actually, you know, process that as they are formulating new regulations or trying to undo Obamacare's regulations? I'm not sure, but, you know, rest assured that if you send them in, they will at least go to that federal agency.
Okay, let's talk about essential benefits. This is the provision. It's a popular provision in Obamacare, according to the Kaiser Foundation's polls, and it mandates that insurance covers stuff. It prevents insurers from selling, you know, policies that are insurance in name only and leave you hanging if you get sick. So there's this kind of, it's a basket of 10 essential benefits: preventive care, pregnancy, prenatal care, maternity, cancer screenings, these kinds of things. Now, you write that Congress can't just repeal them because they're right there in the text of the law. They are, as you say, in the text. But that, does that make them safe?
It does not. Spoiler alert, it does not.
So how are they imperiled without Congress acting?
Right. So what Price could do, Tom Price over at HHS, is, you know, gut the essential health benefits while leaving that framework in place, even if that's only in name. You know, there's another part of the Affordable Care Act that requires coverage of what are known as women's preventative services. But those women's preventative services themselves are defined in regulation. So you have a basket of, there's so many baskets, but you have a basket of, you know, 9 women's preventative services. Things like no copay contraception, which is known as the woman or the popular birth control benefit, breast cancer and cervical cancer screenings, HIV screenings, counseling for STIs, et cetera, et cetera. So what Tom Price could do at HHS is to rewrite, you know, the definition of these women's preventative services, what constitutes women's preventative services. So that overlaps, obviously, with the essential health benefits. So if you think that you're going to go get a breast cancer screening because the essential health benefits are still in place, but Tom Price has decided in these women's preventative services over at HHS that he no longer wants that covered, you're not going to be able to receive that with no copay.
Tom Price, it's funny that some of the most right-wing Republicans and some of the ones who are most adamant about denying people health care or restricting access to health care are doctors. I've always found that to be just this very weird aspect of the Republican coalition.
Yeah, well, and I would say it's funny, but nothing is funny.
No, it's not funny. It's just really ironic. It's like my grandfather was an OBGYN, and the idea that he would ever support anything that restricted people's access to health care is just, I mean, he would just never do it. And I don't know where these people are coming from.
Right. And, you know, I talked to a lot of advocates for both of these pieces, and they did say that, you know, eliminating these other women's preventative services are a harder sell to some extent, right? I mean, we saw the backlash against both Representative John Shimkus when he questioned why men should have to pay for prenatal care, and Senator Pat Roberts when he kind of scoffed at why men should have to pay for mammograms, you know, speaking to a larger and more fundamental misconception of how insurance actually works.
Yes.
You know, things like risk pools and, you know, that cafeteria plans don't really exist except for in Republicans' dreams.
So
we don't know, right, what Tom Price will go after, because, you know, presumably we'll see a big backlash like that again if he goes after breast cancer screenings. But what's to say that he won't go after that or anything else? You know, when he drafted his own Obamacare repeal bill back when he was in Congress and had statutory power, he killed all of the essential health benefits. I don't think that he's any more endeared to women's preventative services. We certainly know that he's going to go after the birth control benefit, try to strike that from women's preventative services. You know, he has been on the record saying that there is not one woman who can't afford birth control, and certainly he's not extending that to transgender or gender nonconforming people as well.
Right, right. And of course, if we were talking about anything that affects men's health, it would be a completely different political situation. I think that with breast cancer, it's one of those things where you have the, you know, the run for the cure and everybody's swinging pink baseball bats in Major League Baseball. That's one of those things that will elicit a backlash. I'm not sure if that's the case with all of these things that we're talking about. The birth control benefit has been a hot potato since the very beginning. By the way, it shouldn't be. Increasing access to birth control decreases unplanned pregnancies and ultimately the number of abortions. But, you know, of course, the anti-choice movement isn't about reducing abortions. But anyway, and of course, it did bring us the wonderful Hobby Lobby ruling, where corporate persons now have a right to their religion. Christine, you write that there are multiple avenues to kill the contraception benefit. What are those different avenues?
Sure. Well, we could see, you know, Tom Price directly go after it, you know, go after these women's preventative services guidelines, instruct that birth control, no copay contraceptives be struck from the women's preventative services guidelines. But we could also see President Trump sign an executive order in the vein of the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You know, it would give the administration a new line of defense in ongoing litigation around this. You know, we've seen rumors that there would be a sweeping kind of what we call religious imposition executive orders that would take away rights for LGBTQ people, but this could also be applied to the birth control benefit as well.
Yeah, we had Sarah Posner on the show talking about that potential religious freedom order. You write, and I quote, that the war extends beyond the so-called women's health benefits, singling out transgender people, pregnant people, and people with low incomes, categories that, of course, are not mutually exclusive. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I mean, we could just summarize it as this war extends to everyone who's not, you know, cisgender and male and white and you know, it really, really starts in with Section 1557 of the law. That's kind of a mouthful, but it's wide-ranging non-discrimination. Both the statutory text of that section and the set of regulations enforcing it, you know, like you said, are designed to protect women and transgender and gender non-conforming people. And so it prevents all entities receiving federal funds from discrimination on the basis of race, skin color, national origin, sex, age, or disability, which are things that we usually see. But the, you know, interesting thing here is that we see a person's sex includes discrimination based on pregnancy, gender identity, and sex stereotyping. So even if you are a religiously affiliated provider, you can't discriminate against, you know, a person seeking sterilization or a person seeking abortion care or a transgender patient seeking, you know, any sort of health care services. So we've already seen, unfortunately, a temporary injunction against Section 1557 earlier this year from a conservative federal judge out in Texas. But we're now also seeing the Trump administration go after it. Trump appointed a very outspoken anti-LGBTQ activist to run the Department of Human Services Office of Civil Rights. He comes from the Heritage Foundation, and not just the Heritage Foundation, but the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society. And the Senate did not have to confirm him to that position. So he, you know, will basically be allowed to not enforce, you know, this wide-ranging non-discrimination for a lot of different people.
Of course, one of the big concerns, or a big concern, is that Trump might destabilize the marketplaces themselves. It's unclear if that's a threat that they're going to follow through on, now that there are a number of polls showing that the public would blame Republicans more than Democrats, because Trump had said that he believed that Democrats would get the blame if the marketplaces unraveled. That's clearly not the case. Currently, have you been following the lawsuit about the provision that reimburses insurers for reducing co-payments for low-income people?
I have not been following that.
Okay, I'm just going to talk about that briefly.
Okay.
Because that's in the news this week. So there was this provision, and it was a regulatory provision that basically Obama allocated money that wasn't strictly in the text of the ACA to help insurers who give discounts on out-of-pocket expenses for low-income people. The Republicans sued the administration for this, and it's widely believed that if these payments are not made, it could cause more insurers to flee the marketplaces. And this week, Donald Trump said that he would cease making those payments if Democrats didn't come to him and make a bargain about repealing their health care law. For me, it's a clear misread of the political landscape. I think the Democrats, and Chuck Schumer made a statement to this effect. He said, "You can't take however many million people hostage and expect us to negotiate with you." The idea that Democrats are going to be cowed into cooperating with Trump to undo the signature health care law. Remember, Democrats tried to pass a universal health care plan since the New Deal for 70 years. The idea that they're going to come and work with this president, this unpopular president, to undo their health care law is just ludicrous. So I think that he's in for a harsh awakening if he believes that that's a way to get around the so-called Freedom Caucus, which has been an enormous pain in his butt, as it has been an enormous pain in everyone else's butts for several years. Anyway.
Well, and I think it's like what you said. It's either an enormous misread or an enormous miscalculation. I mean, we see congressional Republicans, home this week for congressional recess and just getting slammed in these town hall meetings over Obamacare, over the provision that they had in mind to, quote unquote, defund Planned Parenthood by stripping this healthcare organization of Medicaid reimbursements. So to think that this move would work, and I did receive several statements on it from House and Senate Democrats yesterday. And, you know, Senator Patty Murray, who's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Health Committee, said that these comments make it alarmingly clear that President Trump is still considering ripping our healthcare system apart just to score political points, regardless of the devastation it will cause for millions of Americans. And like you said, sabotaging this by holding Americans hostage is really not a tactic we've seen done before, and I don't think it's a tactic that will work.
I am with you, and I think that the messaging is so easy on this that even Democrats can't mess it up. Christine Grimaldi, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I believe we're out of time, but I really do appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much.
Folks, check out Christine's piece. It's at, it's not RH Reality Check anymore. See, I've been doing this for a while. It takes me a while. I'm like just slow on the uptake. It takes me a while to get used to new things. It's at rewire.news. That's not rewire.com, rewire.news. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then talk about North Korea, because how much worse can things get?
There's a place where lovers go to cry. lonesome town where the broken heart stays. You can buy a dream or two to last you all through the years, and the only price you pay is a heart full of tears. Going down to lonesome town where the broken heart stays. Going down to lonesome town to cry my troubles away. In the town of broken dreams, the streets are filled with regret. Maybe down in lonesome town, I can learn to forget. Maybe down in lonesome town, I can learn to forget.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to talk about North Korea, and this is a moving target. I should note that we're recording this interview on Friday evening. Events may have overtaken us by the time you hear this. One can't help but be alarmed by escalating tensions right now. This is a confrontation between two leaders who are widely seen as erratic and thin-skinned. And the potential consequences of this escalating into open conflict are hard to overstate. I'm joined now by Christine Ahn. Christine is a writer and activist, and she's the international coordinator for Women Cross DMZ and a co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute. You can check out Women Cross DMZ at, it's all one word, womencrossdmz.org. Christine, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks, Joshua.
You are our second guest named Christine this week. I'm going to start off with a very basic question. Why are tensions between the U.S. and North Korea rising right now? What's going on?
Well, I mean, they have been going on for some time, but obviously the Trump administration has really heightened tensions, I think, to a new level, largely because my perception is that they want to escalate to have some influence on the outcome of the South Korean election. That is a snap election that will take place on May 9th. Most listeners may or may not know, but in the fall and winter of last year, South Koreans, up to 2 million people, took to the streets and held candlelight vigils weekend after weekend to call for the impeachment of the corrupt president. And they succeeded. The parliament voted, and then the Supreme Court approved it. And so she was impeached and is now facing jail time. And so that led to a snap election being scheduled for May 9th. And the front runner of the presidential election has been a guy named Moon Jae-in, who is the former chief of staff under the last progressive South Korean leader, Roh Moo-hyun. And so he has some experience. He said, I'm going to Pyongyang before I go to Washington. The best guarantee for South Korean security is diplomacy and engagement with North Korea. And since the brinkmanship that the Trump administration has been escalating against North Korea, he's been falling behind the polls, and the business entrepreneur now, Ahn Cheol-soo, is now closely taking over Moon Jae-in's lead. So that's my perception, is that this escalation is being used as a way to create fear in South Korea that could lead to a more hardline president than the current candidate that is the front runner.
So it's an effort to undermine the candidate who is saying that we need to engage with North Korea. You scare the heck out of everybody. And the idea is that that advantages the more hardline candidate who Trump prefers. That's right.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's also a game of, so another thing that is currently taking place is that the former president, Park Geun-hye, had negotiated without any parliamentary discussion in South Korea, the deployment of a U.S. THAAD missile defense system. This is the Lockheed Martin missile defense system, which many experts say that, you know, maybe in, even in good conditions, half the time it would be effective. But this is a hugely expensive, you know, military system that is questionable, and the U.S. has been pushing hard for South Korea to install it. And without debate, without any public discussion about this, Park Geun-hye agreed to do it last year. And since her impeachment, there has been question in South Korea, do we want this? And obviously, it has really angered China, who has viewed that THAAD missile defense system not as a real prevention from North Korean missiles, but instead as a tactic or a tool for surveillance on China. And so it's so interesting because when General Mattis first went to South Korea and Japan, you know, my understanding is that that was a very important discussion, was to ensure that South Korea continued with the deployment. And, you know, they were going to start building the construction in the summer. And basically, the U.S. has quickly sent. So I think that that's also part of the provocation, the heightened military discourse is, you know, to justify the need for this missile defense system.
Chinese state media reported this week, and Chinese state media is widely seen as kind of a communications form for the government, that they basically threatened North Korea. They issued a stronger than usual condemnation and threatened coal shipments to North Korea. Some people are crediting Trump's erratic behavior for pushing China to be tougher than usual on their North Korean counterparts. They think that Premier Xi watching Trump casually order a Tomahawk cruise missile strike on Syria over chocolate cake may have alarmed the Chinese and pushed them to take action. Your view of that analysis?
Well, I think that if anything, what was conveyed in that meeting between President Xi and Trump is that the Korean issue is very complicated, and that to the contrary of most U.S. pundits, is that China does not have influence over North Korea. And North Korea has been advancing and progressing its missile and nuclear weapon systems, despite China, you know, asking that they don't, even though they're their only ally. And so I think that the call on, you know, reversing the coal shipments to North Korea may have been one gesture that China gave to sort of appease Trump. But, you know, they're not going to cut the shipments of oil. They don't want destabilization of North Korea. They don't want regime collapse, which would foment a massive migration crisis, not anywhere near what we have seen with Syria. And, you know, they obviously don't want an escalation that could lead to war, that would draw. And they've already moved 150,000 soldiers to the border with North Korea. And so while we may think and while we may present this image that China wants to be in lockstep with the United States on fomenting some kind of regime change, that is so far from the truth. I mean, China, you know, the way that many Korea analysts view the situation is that the Korean Peninsula is actually, North Korea is unfortunately the boogeyman. It's an easy target for the U.S., but really a lot of what the Obama administration did with the pivot to Asia is in a potential standoff with China. And unfortunately, because of its geopolitical position, the Korean Peninsula is unfortunately ground zero for a U.S. and China conflict.
It is really worrisome.
It sounds depressing, doesn't it? I know, it does. It is
terribly depressing.
But it's an opportunity. And so if we have, I mean, the good news is while I would prefer Moon Jae-in, the more progressive candidate, to come into office, he's much more seasoned. He, you know, obviously knows a lot about how U.S. Foreign policy influenced South Korea and inter-Korean relations. But, you know, either way, Chun-Chul-Soo and Moon Jae-in, they're both pro-engagement with North Korea. So we are going to see a leftward shift in South Korea's position vis-a-vis North Korea. And I think that that's an opportunity. And so how are we as progressives in the United States going to respond to this new day on the Korean Peninsula? And so that is that's my hope at the end of this tunnel here, is once we have a more progressive and liberal candidate or president in the Blue House in South Korea, how the U.S. will have to shift. I mean, if we are honestly and genuinely saying we're there, we've had 28,000 troops in South Korea to protect our allies. And if our allies are saying, hey, we need a different kind of U.S. policy that respects the inter-Korean reconciliation and reunification process, then I think we have to truly adhere to that.
Can you give us a sense of the North Korean perspective on what's going on right now?
Well, I mean, I can't, but I would say that. So one thing that's interesting is that North Korea, despite being under U.S. sanctions, international sanctions, being basically, completely isolated from the international community, they have been able to, grow their economy. And obviously that's very much tied to the growth of China's economy. But, the things that I've read, quotes from North Koreans, and obviously, journalists and foreigners that have access to North Korea are always constantly with minders and, but they do randomly select people on the streets. And, and it's in Pyongyang, obviously it's where the elite live. It's where, the most united behind the regime people live. But, the general sense is, we're going to fight to defend our country. And, as much as that sounds like rhetoric and propaganda, and obviously we know that with the rise of North Korean defectors that have since left over the last 20 years, that, there is not this united voice, all in support of the regime. There's obviously tremendous criticism, but, we have to look at the long history. And, the Korean War is not over. In 1953, the U.S., China, and North Korea signed the Armistice Agreement, a ceasefire that temporarily halted the fighting, and that within 90 days, they promised to return to negotiate a peace settlement. And that has never come to fruition. And so from their long view, they are not like Americans. They have very much every day from the, if anybody has ever traveled to Cuba, the same kind of propaganda posters are very much the part of the daily experience of North Koreans. And so they just have to remember the kind of indiscriminate bombing campaign in which 1 in 3 of their family members were killed by U.S., U.S. bombs. And more bombs were dropped on the Korean Peninsula than in the Asia-Pacific theater in World War II. We introduced napalm. I mean, 80% of North Korea was leveled, and we committed genocide by bombing dams. I mean, just the things that we did there. And in this country, it's called the Forgotten War. But it's really important that we talk about this, because when Martin Luther King said in his Riverside speech that, we're investing all this money into military that's killing the soul of this nation. Well, it was the Korean War that inaugurated that Cold War spending. It is what has led to this massive military-industrial complex. And so I think it would be symbolic if we could try to do something about Korea, because it's not just us that is militarizing to the teeth. It's all of Northeast Asia. So if you look at the top 10 military spenders in the world, half of them are in that Northeast Asia region. It's a tinderbox. And so if we can try to resolve the Korean conflict, I think we can do a lot for the world.
Let's talk about a little bit more recent history. Bill Clinton, it seemed to me, and I'm not a Korea expert, obviously, had made a good deal of progress with North Korea. I mean, we know that he got them to freeze their enrichment program for, I think, 6, 7, 8 years, something like that. He had worked out a tentative deal to buy up their missiles. George Bush came into office and he abandoned those deals, and he declared North Korea part of the Axis of Evil. How significant was that decision, that policy choice, in terms of leading to the tensions that we're experiencing today?
Oh, it's absolutely critical. I mean, you're absolutely right. But not only did Clinton negotiate the freeze, he almost signed a non-aggression pact. I mean, the second highest person at that time, it was Kim Jong-il, the father of the current leader. But, you know, the second highest person had come to the White House and met with Clinton. And they were just steps away from negotiating this. But unfortunately, when I met with, so this is based on what Bill Perry, the former Secretary of Defense, told me, was that, you know, Clinton had a year left. And so he either was going to focus on Israel, Palestine, or on North Korea. And unfortunately, he decided to put his energy towards the Middle East. And obviously, we know where that went. But
yes.
Korea was so close. And in fact, Madeleine Albright went to meet with Kim Jong-il, and she said, this is a regime we can negotiate with. And, you know, unfortunately, we ran out of time. And, you know, the real problem was that Al Gore and what happened during the Florida debacle with George Bush Jr. was that, you know, that basically created the chaos that prevented Clinton from finally normalizing relations with North Korea. So it is a very tragic turn in history. But I think for us to really recognize is what was happening also at that time was Kim Dae-jung was the first, like, really, truly democratically elected president in South Korea. And he had, in 2000, signed a June 15th agreement with Kim Jong-il at the time to begin the process of reconciliation towards eventual reunification. And, you know, he basically came to the White House when George Bush came into power, and he got the door slammed in his face, basically. And, you know, he had pleaded that the U.S. not take a hardline stance, that they wanted to pursue this reconciliation process with North Korea. And unfortunately, that, you know, so the U.S. not only impacts North Korea directly, but our policies also impact South Korea's relationship. And so that's my hope, is that even though there seems to be this imbalance, you know, when Obama was in power, not that Obama had a decent North Korea policy, but right now we have somebody like Trump who is erratic, dangerous, that is dropping motherload bombs, you know, in Afghanistan and Syria.
Yes.
You know, we just don't know what he's capable of doing. And I'm hoping that South Korea is the kind of bulwark against that kind of crazy action. But when that tide shifts, you know, what is going to be the response from the U.S.?
Yeah. Folks, again, we're recording this on Friday evening. Tomorrow, Saturday, is Kim Jong-un's birthday. It is widely believed that he will test an intercontinental ballistic missile, possibly a nuclear warhead. There is a U.S. carrier group steaming towards the region. It's extremely volatile. The Trump administration, their approach has been characterized as applying maximum pressure without seeking regime change. John DeLore at the Tansei University in Seoul gave an interview to Hank Urey, and he said, and I think this is an important thing to understand, thinking that it's a matter of making North Korea hurt enough shows a fundamental misunderstanding of key attribute of the DPRK state and society, which has an extraordinary capacity to absorb pain. They have maybe suffered more than anyone since 1945. They're like a boxer. They'll never beat you, but you can never knock them down. No matter how hard you hit them, they get back up.
Scary stuff.
Yeah. Christine Ahn, I believe we are out of time. I really want to thank you for joining us this week and giving us your perspective. It's really interesting to hear a more detailed analysis than when we get on CNN. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Great. Thanks so much for having me, Joshua.
I'd also like to thank Helene Olin and Christine Grimaldi. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank Crooks and Liars, Hullabaloo, and the Smirking Chimp for letting us park our show over at their respective joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.